Move to the fourth case today. That's Federal Trade Commission versus Bay Area Businesses. Mr. Little.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thomas Little, representing the appellants. May it please the Court, this is an appeal to seek reversal of a summary judgment that was entered by Judge Dara. And that summary judgment is based upon, in essence, the disregarding of the comprehensive affidavit filed by Peter Porcelli, which we believe constituted compliance with Rule 56.1. Judge Dara disregarded that affidavit, finding it to be conclusory and rambling.
Your response to the FTC's Rule 56.1 statement did not continue a single citation to any depositions or other record evidence. Can you please explain how Mr. Porcelli's affidavit, simply contradicting the evidence cited by the FTC, could ever be construed as compliant with Rule 56.1b?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, it does reference other items in the record, and I would specifically refer to paragraph 5, references paragraph 35 of the answer that was filed. Paragraph 7 of the affidavit references paragraph 1 of the answer that was filed. Paragraph 23 attaches a marketing script which is at odds with the alleged FTC script which was included and which is an issue in the case as to whether or not a particular script was used in the telemarketing of the product that was involved. Also, the paragraphs.
Instead of, can you identify any facts that are in dispute that if they were believed by a trier of fact could establish that these defendants did not engage in deceptive practices?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at paragraph 73 of Mr. Porcelli's affidavit, it specifically indicates that the entity BABC, Bay Area Business Council, never sold a MasterCard, that the MasterCard was part of a vacation package, and that BABC was a seller of travel. That fact
is... But let's take that paragraph 73. There is no indication in that paragraph that Mr. Porcelli is competent to testify that. Mr. Porcelli... just sort of says these things. And the other thing I would point out is at one point, somewhat to my surprise, you say, well, every paragraph of Mr. Porcelli's affidavit corresponds with the paragraphs in the FTC statement. Maybe paragraph 73 does, but a great number of them don't. But it's just, it's like saying you've complied with Rule 56.1 simply by saying, I dispute. That's not, we look at like documents or depositions or something, direct testimony, which if you imagine that for some reason he is competent to testify to these things, isn't what happens.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that his direct testimony certainly is relevant as to the issue of material disputed facts. He is the principal of the corporate entities, which is undisputed by the FTC's own allegations. He can testify and provide admissible evidence as to the practices of his business entities. And those business entities, according to his testimony, were not involved in the sale of credit cards. That's reiterated throughout the affidavit in reference to that it was a registered seller of travel and was selling vacation packages, of which the stored value MasterCard, credit card, was a component, but not the main component.
But let me approach this a different way. There are many decisions from this court in which we have said that the district courts are entitled to structure the summary judgment process so that litigation can go forward in an orderly way. And the way the Northern District of Illinois has structured it, which is actually quite typical around the country, is that it's passed Local Rule 56.1. And this doesn't comply with local, at least not literally, with Local Rule 56.1. Are you aware of a single case where we have said that a district judge has abused his discretion when he chose to insist on strict compliance with the rule?
No, Your Honor, but in this case...
So this would be a first. This would be the first time where there is not strict compliance with the rule, and nonetheless... It's not. We're not the district judge. If the district judge had wanted to take this, then the interesting question is, would that have been an abuse of discretion? But that's not this case, because the district judge said, no, I want you to comply with the local rule. So for us as an appellate court, the only question is, was he beyond the pale to take that position? We've never said that.
Well, Your Honor, in a de novo review, I believe it's appropriate to consider whether there are genuine issues of material fact.
But one of the things we do, though, in these procedural decisions is we say you've got, in a sense, to tee up the facts the right way. And if the district judge says you have failed to comply with what we have over and over again said is a reasonable rule for teeing them up like that, that's it. You know, we sustain rulings based on the undisputed facts all the time.
Well, Your Honor, it's our position that the affidavit by Mr. Porcelli presents competent evidence, and it addresses all of the allegations that are raised in the 56 statement by the plaintiffs and contests those statements, though not necessarily correspondingly chronologically.
Well, but let's take paragraph 76 then. There are a lot of things that Mr. Porcelli says. He says he never had a list. He was aware that there were complaints from time to time. And then he says most complaints were without merit. Well, how does he know? He didn't have a list. He didn't see most of them. He's sort of aware that they're there. He doesn't know personally that most complaints were without merit.
Well, but
Judge, he's just finished telling us he doesn't know.
Are we not now in the position of weighing those facts
no,
as opposed
not.
To...
No, we're saying, what do you know about?
Right.
If he said, I personally sat down and read every complaint that ever came in, and it is my assessment that most of them were without merit, there you'd have an interesting question, because he read them all. He tells us he doesn't know about most of them, and then he tells us what they said.
Your Honor, he may not have known about the specific complaints, but he knew about the overall tenor of the type of complaints that were received.
How many complaints do you contend there were?
Your Honor, I don't think we contend there were a specific number of complaints that we have identified as far as a number of them. It's our position, and I understand the court's argument, but it's our position that given that this is a summary judgment and that the affidavit that was submitted was disregarded strictly as conclusory, but yet Mr. Porcelli is competent to provide admissible testimony, we believe that the district court judge incorrectly disregarded the entire affidavit and weighed the affidavit, which is not a proper function in determining material issues of...
Well, with regard to the question that Judge Wood was asking, he's not competent to provide an opinion as to whether or not there were the complaints had merit, since he didn't look at them, is he?
Well, Your Honor, that's one fact.
I mean, if you had him on the stand and you said, did you look at the complaints, he said, well, I saw one or two, but then you're not going to be able to ask him, well, did they have merit, the entire group, right?
Yes, sir. No, can't disagree with that point.
Part of the affidavit, at least that portion, he's not competent to make.
Limited us to that point.
Well, right. We could go down a number of items, but that's just one example.
But the overall issue of the sale of credit cards, which is really the foundation of the government's claim, is clearly disputed by the affidavit and the facts therein, where he indicates that the company was a seller of travel and was not selling MasterCards, and in fact it was a stored value MasterCard, not an actual credit card. That was a component of the travel package. That is clearly specified in the affidavit and is clearly raised as a fact in dispute, which is really the linchpin of the government's entire case. Not necessarily how many complaints there were, but the nature of the activity and the product that were being sold by the companies involved. And we contend those issues in and of themselves create material issues of fact. The inferences have to be placed in the favor of the appellant, and the court should not have weighed those and disregarded the entire affidavit by merely making a statement that it was conclusory. It didn't address any areas in sense, saying it was rambling and conclusory and therefore would be disregarded and all the facts would be deemed admitted.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Singer.
May it please the court, my name is John Andrew Singer and I represent the Federal Trade Commission in this matter. Just to hit on a couple of points that came up in the appellant's argument, Your Honors. First, absolutely the standard of review for evidentiary issues, including admissions of the Federal Trade Commission's statement of facts pursuant to Rule 56.1A, is a standard of abuse of discretion. This court said that in the Bordelon case, and it's also quite clear from cases such as Cooper Shutt and Lucas versus Chicago that such summary judgments based on evidentiary issues can only be overturned for an abuse of discretion, or put another way, where failure to do so would be inconsistent with substantial justice, which clearly I would submit is not the case here. Looking at the facts under Rule 56.1A as put by the statement, as put by the Federal Trade Commission, I'll just make three simple points, which are also admitted at various points in Mr. Porcelli's affidavit, coincidentally or not. Defendants, through telemarketers, promised consumers they would receive an unsecured MasterCard credit card with a substantial credit limit in return for an advance fee of $200 to $400.
Well, see, I wanted to ask you about that because Mr. Little was just saying that that the dispute is whether it was a real MasterCard or a stored value card. But I thought the dispute was, in fact, what the people were told that it was. I mean, the FTC—that's the problem, actually, not the solution—that it wasn't a real MasterCard. The FTC knows that it wasn't.
It is absolutely correct. Not a single person, and defendants admit this, if you were to get beyond the Rule 56.1A statement, that they did not sell MasterCards. They gave out a piece of plastic that had a number on it. It was, I think, the same number on every card. It wasn't even embossed, and a black painted strip on the back.
But the real question is, if we were to get beyond this Rule 56.1 issue, and I'm not at all sure that we would, but if we did, is there, as Mr. Little was saying, any dispute about what the telemarketers were saying to the consumers who were contacted?
I would submit that there's not, Your Honor. There are dozens of complaints that are part of the record indicating this from consumers. There's a recording from, I believe, January 30th, 2002 that makes these. There's sales scripts that were given to BABC, an American Leisure card, the successor to BABC, that have the identical scripts attached to them. It's what the telemarketers provided as being given to that. And perhaps most importantly, and this goes back to Mr. Porcelli's affidavit, he indicates he did not listen to a single telemarketing call.
What are we to make of this? Your theory, if he and Harris never actually heard the telemarketers, wouldn't that undercut your theory that they're individually liable?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because in fact they were receiving, by Kristen Davis's estimate, somewhere on the order of, I believe, somewhere between 750 complaints a day. Mr. Porcelli, and I think it's paragraph 74, indicates they were receiving about 1,700 complaints a day about credit cards. And Mr. Porcelli, even when he was in Canada with his softball team, was getting a daily grid indicating both the number of complaints and the nature of those complaints about the credit cards which Ms. Harris provided for him. So they knew specifically, without hearing the calls, that they were getting hundreds of calls per day about this very problem from consumers. Additionally, another 900 or so complaints were forwarded by Better Business Bureau divisions, as well as various states, in particular Montana and North Carolina, which brought actions very similar to the FTC's.
What about what I was going to ask you is, what are we to make, though, of this Exhibit A to Mr. Porcelli's affidavit, which he identifies in paragraph 75 as the only telemarketing script that that was ever used except for the name change, which is this thing, you know, in the appendix. I'm sure you're familiar with it. If that's the only thing that was ever used, then isn't there a dispute of fact?
If you were to get beyond Rule 56.1A, assuming
that,
I don't think that would create a fact here, Your Honor, because the fact is that, one, I think Mr. Porcelli's affidavit, as the district court correctly put it, is itself without credibility, and the district court could reject it. Additionally, there is a recording from the Department of Justice's Senior Sentinel program, which recorded an actual sales call. It is inconsistent with what Mr. Porcelli says is the only sales script that was made. I would submit that Mr. Porcelli, as are most affidavits, in fairness, self-serving, he can put up anything that he would like, but the proof is in the pudding, and the one absolutely indisputable fact is there was a recording that said this. There are dozens of consumer declarations, and I would say that one self-serving affidavit with a self-serving script attached to it, in light of the other evidence, does not in fact create a fact, particularly given Mr. Porcelli's the lack of credibility in Mr. Porcelli's declaration. I'd also add that Mr. Porcelli's declaration in many instances contradicts itself, and more and equally importantly, totally ignores three full days of depositions and things that he said were contrary. It's as if he's just wiped out the past like Alice in Wonderland, and is saying,
our case law says you cannot defeat your deposition by an affidavit following affidavit.
I'm well aware of that, Your Honor. I'm certain you were as well.
What was the temporal sequence? The depositions were first and then the affidavit, or the other way around?
The depositions were concluded first, Your Honor. There's a footnote in my brief, if I may. The declaration was filed in opposition to the summary judgment. The depositions were held, I don't recall the exact dates, but they were all in advance of that.
Will the record tell us if this...
It's in footnote... Pardon me, it's in
footnote 4.
Yes.
Will the record tell us if this is ongoing in any other state in the union?
If what is ongoing, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
This
action?
Whatever you want to call this, yes.
I would call it a scam, but you might be more polite than I am, Your Honor. It is not by Mr. Porcelli, as far as we are aware at this point. One of the reasons that the FTC brought this action, and in similar cases brings other actions, is, as you can see from the record, North Carolina brought an action, and what happened was people in North Carolina, if they were called, and often, I believe it was in this case, telemarketers have in their boiler rooms, do not call North Carolina because there's an action there for their telemarketers. They just stop calling that state. The advantage of the FTC...
Is that a civil action in North Carolina or a criminal action?
I believe it was civil, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that the FTC can do, which is quite helpful, is since we're a nationwide agency and can get a nationwide injunction from a district court, when we bring an action, we can stop this type of activity in one fell swoop throughout the country, as opposed to states which can just operate one state at a time. And much as they might cooperate, it would be 51 separate actions, including the District of Columbia.
I had a quick question for you about what exactly is here before us, because we have both an injunction that the commission obtained from the district court based on this summary judgment, and also this order to, whatever you want to say, you know, disgorge the $12.5 million or damages. If that's damages, then on a 1292A1 appeal, it's not in front of us. If it's something else, then tell me why it is in front of us.
I will tell you why.
It
is in front of you, and it should be, and it's proper to be there, Your Honor. And it should be under 1292A1. What happens is, if you look, taking a step back to put it in context, if you look at 15 U.S.C. Section 53B, which is what authorizes the Federal Trade Commission to go into court under Section 5A and derivatively under the telemarketing sales rule, you'll see in the second proviso...
That's the 13B authority?
13B is what I would use, or Section 53B of Title 15. You'll see under the second proviso that the Federal Trade Commission has the authority to go in and seek a permanent injunction against someone who's doing something like the defendants in this action. What has developed in over 30 years of jurisprudence, and the Amy Travel case from this circuit in 1989 is an example, indicates the authority the FTC has to go into court is purely equitable in nature. We don't have the ability to go in and seek civil damages. other than sometimes civil penalty cases, which this is not one. All we have the ability to do is to go in and seek injunctive relief.
Even though in substance, presumably, if you ever see any of this money, you will distribute what you can to the victims?
We would distribute it as redress or restitution to the victims. We don't keep any of it. I just want to emphasize to fund ourselves.
It goes to the Treasury, I think, if you don't.
Treasury is the payee of last resort, but we do try to get it out. But the bottom line is why I have to admit, you know, someone who is not a lawyer might say, what's the differences between damages and restitution? And I might be hard-pressed to state what it would be. Having, as a lawyer, I know that there is a big difference between equitable restitution and damages. It's a different legal theory, and in fact, the FTC can only go into the courts under an equitable theory. Hence, we're here under injunctive relief. It just so happens that this injunction includes a monetary restitution aspect to it, but at the end of the day, it is part of the equitable remedies. It's not part of the, it's not a civil damages case. I see my time is up, unless Your Honors have any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Little, you've exhausted your time, but I'll give you a minute if you'd like.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor.
If I could just briefly note, first of all, the issue that was raised concerning the call that counsel referred to, the existence of that call and its applicability to this program was disputed in Mr. Porcelli's affidavit. Again, we have the issue of weighing these factual concerns. It's our position that these facts should not be weighed or looked at in some way. If there are issues of fact, those issues of fact should not be determined by a motion for summary judgment. To get by that point, of course, we have to start with the first point on Rule 56.1. We believe that we have substantially complied with that with Mr. Porcelli's affidavit. The case cited by the district court, Smith versus Lamar, was a situation where a number of issues were raised and only part of them were addressed, and that was the reason for the deeming of facts in that case. We believe that all issues that were raised by the FTC were addressed by the affidavit, and therefore all factual matters were addressed. None of them were specifically determined to be objected to or to be in contradiction to a deposition. No motions were filed to object to them, to strike them. The whole affidavit was simply disregarded as conclusory, and we believe that that was an improper weighing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Little. Thanks to counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.